The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
Welcome. I think it's amazing that on a rainy, wet, soggy Friday night that we're all here. Of all the places we could be and all the things we could be doing, this is where we chose to be. That we're choosing to come and to sit together in silence and to turn our awareness to our direct, immediate experiences, pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. We're just practicing together. So, I just want to thank you for that. You know, I began this evening's meditation, for those of you who were here about a half hour ago, with a question, which is, what brought you here tonight? And then I asked it again. And when I ask that question to myself, what it inevitably boils down to is that I'm here because I just want to be happy. Like everybody else in this room, like everybody else outside this room, we just want to be happy. So caring about this life and this happiness relates to the theme of this evening's talk. And the talk is Awake at the Switch, Protecting One's Own Happiness in Difficult Conditions. So I want to start by talking about what that means. And I'll start with the protecting one's own happiness, the happiness part of that. Because that's what brings me to this, my practice on the cushion and off the cushion. So by happiness, I'm not talking about the kind of happiness that comes and goes with whether I'm getting what I want in my life or not. I'm talking about a happiness that's not dependent on things going the way I think they should. And I have some very strong opinions about how I think they should be going. But I'm talking about a happiness that is independent of those outside circumstances. A kind of unshakable state of heart and of mind that is responsive for whatever it is that life throws my way. I get these little videos that come into my email box from the Turgar folks, Mingyur Rinpoche, and he's this great Tibetan master, meditation master, and I got one about a month ago about him talking about happiness, and when he talks about happiness, it's like bubbles through his like being, like across my computer screen and into my heart. And he talked about it as an experience that comes from within. And I wish you could hear his voice. Calm, peaceful, joyful, clear, openness, freedom. He says that if we look for happiness in outside phenomena, we go up and down and up and down, like the stock market, like the waves in the ocean. So how do we go about cultivating the kind of happiness that doesn't go up and down and up and down, like the stock market, like the waves in the ocean? And what does it mean to protect one's own happiness? So for me, those questions have something to do with the first image in the title of this talk, which is being awake at the switch. So if you notice, it's not very usual that when someone's talking that behind them there's a picture, but I put one there. And I want to tell you the story about it, this big framed image of a couple of railroad switches, railroad tracks that could go both ways in like the junction at which they split. So last fall, I was talking with an old friend about one of my personal relationships that was in a really hard, really hard place. And I want to share the story because I want to get some clarity on what was going on with me. And I also wanted to just experience this friend's love and support. So I'm noticing as I'm talking about the conversation, though, instead of talking about my own experience, I'm really dwelling on the experience of the other humans involved in this scenario that I'm describing. And it was like being pulled down this really well-worn railroad track. And it was the track of, boy, you know, if only someone else had made like this other choice, then like I would be happy. Like I would be happy. If only, if only, if only, if only, if only. Woulda, coulda, woulda, coulda, woulda, coulda, 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 woulda, coulda, woulda, coulda. Okay. All right. So as I'm talking to this friend, all right, it's like this familiar, repetitive, going nowhere, dead end track. Woulda, coulda, woulda, coulda, woulda, coulda, shoulda, shoulda, shoulda. And suddenly, in the middle of this, out of nowhere, pops up this image. And it's the image that's behind me, the image of like a railroad switch. And I don't think I've ever actually seen a railroad switch, except for maybe in a Buster Keaton movie. I think that's the only one, I think that's where this came from. And with it came this phrase, awake at the switch. Awake at the switch. And you're probably familiar with the idiom, asleep at the switch. And I kind of looked it up, and it's pretty obvious, but it's basically, you know, it's not paying attention. And it comes from the idea that someone's actually falls asleep when they're responsible for operating the switching device that allows the train to move from one track to another. And this idiom really describes someone who's courting disaster by not paying attention. For example, you know, health experts were asleep at the switch when the disease began to spread rapidly again, and that's sort of how it gets used conventionally. So in the middle of this conversation, I'm having this phrase going through my head, and I'm seeing these like vivid picture of a railroad sort of switch mechanism, what it looks like. And I'm also viscerally having the felt sensations, imagining what it would actually take to like physically like have the effort to pull the right levers that would reroute a train's tracks so that it would switch a train that had momentum, like from going down one course to going down an alternate route. And in that moment, I realized that's what I need. That's what I need to be awake and to actually make the effort when I'm woulda, coulda, woulda, coulda, woulda, coulda, to actually shift the train track so that the train, the momentum of my own heart and mind can go down a track that's going to have more likelihood to bring me real happiness in the moment and down the road. So this year I started printing out images of railroad switches from the internet, and then I would like tweak them so they look like drawings like this, and then I'd blow them up, and then I'd color them in with pastels, and then I'd hang them all over and post them all over my house. And this one that's up here, that's sort of these two, this one hangs across from my bed. So it's the last thing that I see at night, and it's the first thing that I see in the morning. And it's a reminder that our life is constantly at the switch. We're constantly navigating change. And choice points at all levels of scale. So there's the sort of like the big ones, where do we want to live, and what are my priorities? There's the immediate actions, like, will I go to Common Ground tonight, or am I going to stay home and watch my Chinese soap opera? And especially this sort of micro scale, which is, in this moment, what's really the most skillful track for the terrain of my own thought and feeling, my own heart and mind. So, awake at the switch. Whenever I give a talk, I try to give a talk about how I'm practicing right now. This is how I'm practicing right now. This is it. So the other part of the theme, another part of the theme of this evening, awake at the switch, protecting one's own happiness in difficult conditions. Difficult conditions. In relationships, in our work situations, in our interactions with the world, in the world's interactions with us. Some difficult conditions are acute. Lose a job, but then we get a new one. Child gets sick, but the child gets well. Other difficult conditions have that quality of being sustained. In the past couple of years, I've worked with a couple thousand different leaders, and many of them are from communities of color. And I have heard and witnessed again and again the ongoing challenges of being African American or Asian American or Latina or Latino in societies that divide us by race, assign a hierarchy of rank, and then advantage some of us over others. So there are these difficult conditions that arise and pass away more immediately, and then there are those that are long-lasting. This evening, I want to talk about how we connect our meditation practice in times of challenge, whether those are short-lived or long-lived. How do we connect our meditation practice with all the seasons of our lives? The difficulties of our lives can really wake us up the switch. I think Marcia Rose said, "There's nothing like a wallop of suffering to stir one's resolve to practice toward the sensation of suffering." So, our difficulties, the suffering we experience, they can be a powerfully motivating source that deepens our commitment to our own spiritual life. There's a Pali word for that, which is samvega, which is sometimes translated as spiritual urgency, but it actually has multiple levels of meaning. And the challenges in our lives can really move us and inspire us. They can inspire this samvega, this urgency, and this ardency to dedicate ourselves to awakening. What moved you to come here and practice tonight? You could be sitting in a cafe with a friend having a glass of wine, maybe going to a movie. What brought you here tonight? I want to talk just a little bit about samvega in the life of the Buddha, from a really sort of classic story. So, and this is one that I'm not sure of anything that you probably know, but maybe not. So, probably. So, you know, the Buddha began his life as a sheltered prince living in luxury. And this is the classic story that's told over and over again about how Prince Siddhartha left the palace one day and he saw an old person and he was really shocked and he asked his driver, "What's that?" And his driver informed him that is an old person and that, yep, that's going to happen to everyone. Everyone gets old. And then, Prince Siddhartha, who had been extremely sheltered, according by the story, he saw someone who's sick, and there's that same shock and that same news. Yep, everyone will get sick. And then he sees a corpse. Shock and news. Everyone will die. And then the prince saw this wandering monk who was kind of radiant and serene, and the prince was really curious, really wondering about the monk. So my understanding is this, that story, as it's often told, is not actually in the Pali canon, which is the canon that is sort of this lineage of practice arises out of. The Buddha tells the story as something that happened to a previous Buddha, so that's where the story comes from. But I want to talk about it as what sparked Sambhega for the Buddha. Actually, I don't want to talk about it. I want to tell you what Tanisara Bhikkhu says about it. The first emotion you're supposed to bring to the training is Sambhega. That's the emotion Prince Siddhartha felt on seeing the old person, the sick person, and the dead person. Sambhega is a word that doesn't quite have an equivalent in English. It means a sense of shock or dismay or urgency, and it's related to the adjective Samviga, or terrified. It's a chastened realization of what life is like, that the pleasures you've been pursuing are fleeting and never really provide satisfaction. Look at yourself. You are fleeting. And the amount of suffering in life, not only is life fleeting, but there's a lot of suffering before you actually fleet totally away. So taken on its own, Sambhega can be a very depressing realization, which is why it needs to be paired with pasada, or confidence. Confidence that there's a way out. In the famous story about young Prince Siddhartha seeing the old person, the sick person, and the dead person, he also saw a forest mendicant, and that was his fourth vision. His realization after seeing the forest mendicant was, this must be the way out. If there's any way out, this is it. And so he pursued that conviction with a strong sense of clarity and confidence. So Sambhega is the emotional dimension of what drives us to be here. And it's wholesome to include both our emotional, our emotional life and our cognitive life, our thoughts, in the whole, to be whole in our training. But there's something a little tricky about this that's helpful to watch out for. Because sometimes when spiritual urgency is really high and the ardor for practice is really strong, and I've seen this tendency in myself and I've seen it in others, we can actually wind up distorting the practice and using it to avoid the great mess of our lives. John Wellwood coined the term spiritual bypass. And he defined it as using spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep personal, emotional, unfinished business, to shore up a shaky sense of self and to belittle basic needs, feelings, and developmental tasks, all in the name of enlightenment. Spiritual bypass involves bolstering our defenses rather than our humility. Bypass involves grasping rather than gratitude, arriving rather than being, avoiding rather than accepting. So there's this this tension between the Sambhega, between the pain and the suffering of our lives that inspires ardor, and this tricky little thing that can happen sometimes where we wind up bypassing what we really need to turn towards can acknowledge. There's a phrase that I love that comes out of the 12-step movement, which is emotional sobriety. And as somebody who, when in times of challenge, my emotional activity can drive the train down a track that may not actually be very skillful. So I love this idea of emotional sobriety. It's about being able to turn towards what I'm feeling emotionally, and it means not resorting to blaming life when it isn't going the way I want it to. That is because it takes being awake at the switch to even know there's an opportunity to change the railroad track, and then it takes a kind of effort, a kind of skillful effort to reroute the train. So it means that I don't do something to make the unpleasant feelings go away. Kristen Neff was here in town this week, and she's a researcher around self-compassion, and I was with her today. And she talked about the paradox of self-compassion. And the paradox is between accepting what is, but we also want to alleviate suffering. So, what do you do with those? And she said, we give ourselves compassion not to feel better, but because we feel bad. And that's a real difference. If you use compassion to try and just make the pain go away, that's just another slick form of resistance. And it can be really humbling to acknowledge how much we are hurt by life sometimes. And that's just what it is to be human. Ain't no way around it. About a week ago, I woke up and I got the news that our garage had been broken into, and our neighbors had been storing their bicycles in our garage, and they got stolen. So this morning unfolded really fast. The police were there. We gave reports. I tracked down the neighbor who was in Texas, who was storing her motorcycle in the garage, and I arranged for my husband to, you know, survey what else might be missing, and arranged for the locksmith who was going to replace the deadbolt, and I drove my daughter to school, who usually bikes, and then I came to Common Ground. Okay, here I am. I'm sitting here. And because I was going to be giving a talk tonight about protecting one's happiness in difficult conditions, I thought, I think I have some difficult conditions. And they're not the most horrible conditions, but I think given the state of my heart and mind after that morning, that counted. So I went home, and I sat, and then I went home and I wrote what had happened while I was on the cushion, because I wanted to track it. So I want to share that with you, and as I do, I just want you to invite you just to listen to the inside of my mind, which and to listen for the switch points in this sort of unfolding. Okay, so I sit down and I adjust my posture and I start to pay attention to what's happening. And the first thing I notice is there's this kind of rigidity in my upper chest. It's like this stiff sensation that has the flavor of, like, defense or guardedness. There's a kind of gripping in my jaw and a clutching all around my eyes. That's the sound. And it's very unpleasant, but there's also this sense of relief in just sitting there and turning towards the discomfort. And it's kind of like when you've been on vacation and you come home and you realize you've left your house a mess. And it's kind of really good to be home, but at the same time, you know you have a lot of cleaning up to do. Well, that's kind of what it was like, sitting there. So, meanwhile, I'm noticing this internal mess and this flavor of defense and this tightness. And there's also a kind of an awakeness and a knowingness that's present. And a thought arises. This knowingness is the knowing faculty in the mind. And meanwhile, this mind is really agitated and it's jumping from image to image, and there's the police and then there's the neighbors and there's the locks and the bicycles and replaying fragments of the story in the morning. And as that's happening, the body is heating up, like literally getting hot. Like I want to take off my sweater. And then as it's happening, the mind starts to escalate, starts to slide into this pattern of fault finding and like blaming. How did it happen? Was the door left unlocked? Who would have left the door unlocked? He shoulda, she shoulda, coulda, shoulda, coulda, shoulda, coulda, shoulda, coulda, shoulda, coulda, shoulda. Okay, so the mind starts fantasizing all these scenarios of how this had happened. And with each scenario in my mind, it's like I'm throwing a little dart directly at who might be responsible. And there's, as I say that, there's this kind of like little sort of smile at the relief of seeing it, and there's this sadness at the relief of knowing that that's what this mind was doing. It's like this rabid search for satisfaction of knowing how the burglary, how this disruption to my life happened. So, I wouldn't exactly call it pleasant, but all the, like, the momentum of this blaming, this fault-finding, like, activity, it continues to build, and it feeds on itself, and it actually starts to concentrate the mind. It's like the mind begins to focus. And this activity of assigning blame is actually, it's unifying the mind. And, So instead of the mind jumping around from image to image, it's starting to center. Sound arising. Sound passing away. So meanwhile, like the knowing faculty is really present. And energetically, there's all this energy in the head and arms and this angry sort of lashing out dart throwing thing with like is happening. And I am like way outside myself energetically, almost as if I'm sitting about 2 feet in front of myself. But because at some point there's this knowing of that, knowing energy is 2 feet in front of body, it's a switch point. And this question happens. What comes up? What's happening right now? And with that question, this awareness starts to spontaneously shift back to the sensation in the body. And the sensation's barely accessible. I can't feel anything other than this sort of energetic sort of like lashing out pattern. And then there's a thought. This thought just comes up. I know there must be suffering that's driving all this. Laughing arising. Passing away. So it's like something's driving this, but I don't know what it is. I can't feel it. I can't find it. My torso, legs, head, face, none of it's accessible. It's like a complete sort of blank, numb, no sensation. And then compassion arises. I care about this suffering. I can't even find it, but I care about it. I know it's there. And I care about this suffering. And with that thought, awareness starts to drop back inward. And I can feel my immediate embodied experience again. I can feel the sensations in my torso. And, like, my left shoulder suddenly drops. I had no idea. I was wearing it somewhere up around my ears. It just drops. And the breath inside this rigid torso, it's like there's this tiny bit of physical softness that just starts to emerge in the chest. And I notice there's a flavor of sadness. And thoughts arise. I can't control this life. I can't control anything. Can't. And that's what's present. And awake to that sadness and this grief. The mind starts to spontaneously offer these metaphrases to myself. It happens. Expressions of loving kindness. May I be safe and protected in all ways. And the words aren't some idle, like they're not some idle exercise. The words aren't some wish for the future. In this moment, I am actually feeling the yearning for this being to be safe and protected in all ways. The yearning to be protected from burglars and people I care about and love who don't lock doors right. And the yearning to be protected from my own dart-throwing, lashing-out mind and from the gripping around my eyes and the rigidity in my chest and this heart, this poor heart that's just so guarded. Ouch. May I be safe and protected in all ways. May I be peaceful and deeply happy. And they're not wishes. These are an embodied, corporeal, sensate experience of this being that longs for peace. And if I want to amplify that sensation, it's like, let me see if I can, it's this. There's this like spiral in the body, and then there's like the upper torso's leaning as if into the future. May I be peaceful and deeply happy. This is the coordination that was underlying it. This is what it feels like for this particular being to long for peace and to long for being deeply happy. And that moment, this being is obviously neither. And then this thought arises. In this moment, this is just as close as I can get to peaceful. This is just as close as I can get to happy. And with that thought, I'm no longer fighting the moment. I'm no longer resisting this discomfort, spiraling, yearning into some other moment. And there's this flavor of acceptance that's present. And this is just as close as I can get to my own happiness right now. The loving kindness phrases continue. May I be strong and healthy. And with those words, the mind starts to turn to this, like, still this rigidity in the chest and in the face and this hiked up shoulder. And all of a sudden, the word strong and supple come to mind. And it's like, huh? Huh? And then, like, literally, confusion. Mind starts ping-ponging. Strong couple. Strong supple. I don't get it. Strong supple. Strong. And it was like this ping, 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 ping. And it ping-pongs around. May I be strong and healthy? Ah, healthy. And the mind starts sensing the rigidity and the imbalances and the posture and the tension and the gripping and the tensions and the awkward aching in the back and the pinching on the lower side of the neck. And I just want to shake it all off and I just want to fix it all right now. Like right now. And the knowing faculty arises, and I am really tasting this drivenness to fix it now. The direct felt experience of aversion. Welcome home. Welcome home. May I be strong and healthy. This is just as close as I can get to healthy in this moment. And with that thought, the whole system just settles down. just relaxes just a little bit. Subtle is significant. That counts. There's an incremental movement towards accepting the present moment. May I live with ease and joy? And, like, there's ease present. Where did that come from? There's ease. It's there. And the knowing faculty knows ease is present. Knowing that there's a yearning for joy and fully tasting this experience of yearning for joy and all the sensations that are associated with longing for joy and this sinking feeling below the eyes, this is just as close as I am to joy in this moment. No closer, no farther away. And the bell rings, because remember, this is all a half-hour sit at Common Ground. The bell rings. And in that instant, I notice there is no need to be anywhere else. I really am fine. Fineness is present. And sort of happy, just kind of sitting there, no longer fighting reality. Just really okay. Okay enough. And the bell rings again. And the bell rings a third time. A lot of switching points and a lot of switch points in that story. Moments when the mind could have gone one way and it went another. And this process of being awake at those switching points is really subtle and it's really nuanced. It could easily sound like I'm just trying to take over the unpleasant moments and make them better. It's like there's a subtle way in which this could slide into like trying to grab control of So how do we tell the difference between this quality of being awake at the switch and the quality of grabbing control? Grabbing for the controls when things are not the way we want them to be, and how do you tell the difference? Sylvia Boorstein has been a really important teacher for me, and in the 90s, I remember going into an interview with her, and I asked, how do you know what to say to people when they come in for a one-on-one interview with you? How do you know? And she said, she really listens for what do they need to stay balanced. What do you need to stay balanced? So, you know, when the mind is like really heavy-handed or on the verge of overwhelm, then maybe what you need is to get a cup of tea. When the mind is really kind of slack and kind of limp, maybe what you need is to apply the effort to switch. It's like, what do you need to stay balanced? And that question has really, and that has been like an instruction that has been a compass for my own practice over the years as I have increasingly taken responsibility for guiding my own practice. That question has been really important to me. What do I need to stay balanced? And one of the things, the resources that I use a lot is my creativity to address whatever I find in response to that question. So whether it's, okay, what I need to stay balanced right now is to remember to be awake at the switch points, and then I start going on the internet for pictures of railroad switches and printing them out and blowing them up and coloring them in and posting them around my house. I have a lot of props. I use props a lot. And it's because I have a really busy mind, but also a very concrete mind. An important sort of aspect of practice is learning to really know the idiosyncrasies of your own mind. That is like a completely different mind than any other mind. And there's also some similarities, of course. We all want to be happy. So one of the ways I work with this particular mind that tends to be really busy but also and gets agitated easily but also it's very concrete, is I use a lot of props to help me remember and remind me of my own intention to use the challenges of my everyday life to help me wake up and inspire me to more wisdom and more compassion. So if you've been practicing, you've probably heard this a bazillion times. If you've been practicing for a while, which is that mindfulness is simple, but it isn't easy. So turning our attention to what's going on in this very moment, it's a pretty basic thing. How's your breath right now? What's the flavor of sensation in this body? What's the flavor of thought in the mind? What's being heard? What's being seen? What's being known? Pretty basic stuff. But what's hard is to remember. To remember, to notice what is happening right here and right now. So I use my own creativity a lot to help keep my practice fresh and to keep my own aspirations in the front of my mind. And this is especially critical during challenging conditions and in situations that are most likely to seduce my attention into a compelling story. So when the conditions of my life are going to really like pull me down the train track, okay, how do I stay awake in those moments when I'm least likely to be equanimous? So, what do I need to remind me to pay attention so that that possibility that Mingyur Rinpoche was speaking to, that is always present, that possibility of calm, peaceful, joyful, clear, openness, freedom, that might be available? So I'm going to show you some of my, is this show and tell time? So I've shown some of my, like, I have this huge bag of, like, tricks that I've sort of filled up. So the first one, okay, so this is my dog tag. This is a dog tag that I made. I got these these blank dog tags at the party store, and then I just print out whatever I'm needing to remember. And then I like stick it next to my heart. This one is, how might this moment be if it were aligned with my highest aspiration? And when the proverbial poop hits the fan, can I really come back to, okay, this moment, like I mean this one, how would this particular moment be if it were aligned with my highest aspiration? If I was really using the challenging moments of my life to inspire more wisdom and compassion, what would that mean? So I'm going to start with the jewelry. Okay, so this one is, this is a endless knot. And this one was, for me, I specifically went out, I wanted this because I wanted to remember that when the difficult moments happen, to realize that they are part of something, an endless knot that is much, much larger than just that moment or the situation or me, that is fundamentally interconnected and interwoven with a much larger field. So that's what this reminds me of. Okay, next. I never wear more than one, except this first time I've ever done this tonight. Okay, so this is in the morning. Sometimes I'll get up and I'll sort of write. I have a, sometimes I'll write in the morning, what is it that I need to remember from this day, for this day moving forward. And then I kind of stick it in here. This one says, this is from April 12th in 2013. I wanted to remember to lead with grace and calm. And then in August, I wanted to remember to commit to compassion for self and others. Devotion to freedom from conditioned and driven ways of being. I wanted to remember considerate and civil behavior and abstain from AS. That means abusive speech. It's kind of a rough day. So that's on, that's that one. So that's like these just little things to spark that I remember, just to spark my remembering. Another one was my a strong gratitude practice. So I have a gratitude journal in which, as I go through, I often write down what I'm grateful for and different variations. And I have it on my iPhone, a gratitude app. So I go through the day, and on some days, multiple times throughout the day, just say, okay, you know, every couple hours, I'm just going to write down what I'm grateful for that just happened. Really inclining the mind in the direction of gratitude. My iPhone. I feel like I could write a whole book about the way I use my iPhone as a good friend, literally. So, compassion, self-compassion. So sometimes I'll notice when my mind is particularly sort of snarky and critical of self or others, what I'll do is I'll sort of write down the messages that are like the antidote to that, that I would most love to hear from like an ideal teacher or an ideal friend or an ideal mother or, you know, an ideal angel on my shoulder. And then after sitting, when my mind is settled, I'll then record myself saying those phrases and saying those messages back to myself. And then in the moments I get hooked, it is kind of mind-boggling to hear my own voice with such wisdom and such love and such kindness speaking back to me. It's like carrying my own best friend, the voice of my own best friend, and then over time that voice becomes the voice that I'm hearing all the time. So sometimes I'll take stuff from like the suttas or the canon or the liturgy or the, and I'll play with it so that it becomes immediately useful. So for example, I'm thinking about the Metta Sutta that we often do here at Common Ground. There's a phrase which is, may I not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. So at one point, I sort of adopted that. What would it be to go through the next week, just noticing, may I not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. And then when I noticed, again, what do you need to stay balanced? Noticed a slight tightening, it was getting a little rigid, little kind of shudda. Then I tweaked it to, may I live in such a way that the wise ones will later rejoice. Lived with that one for a while. May I live in such a way that the wise ones will later rejoice. What does it mean when the proverbial poop hits the fan? To be responding in such a way that the wise ones will later rejoice. And then that one started to feel like a little bit like out there, kind of some, but it felt a little bit sort of disconnected. So I tweaked it again and it was, may I live in such a way that I will be one of the wise ones rejoicing. May I live in such a way that I will be one of the wise ones rejoicing. And then I put it on my iPhone and I play it back to myself when I really need it. Oh. Phone calls with my girlfriends. I really like to reach out for help. I really do. And my girlfriends and I, we often, you know, call each other and just check in. And also call each other when we're really checked out. And often the first thing we'll say is when some, you know, like if I'm, you know, one of us is dealing with a particularly kind of gnarly issue, and the response will be, okay, what do you want? Do you want girlfriend comfort? Oh, baby, that's so lousy. I can't believe you're dealing with that. That's really hard. Or do you want to cut through delusion? What's the belief you have about how life should be? And so we'll literally ask, what do you want? You want girlfriend do you want like the pillow or do you want the sword? And we'll literally say, okay, no, I want to cut through this stuff. I want to cut through it. I want to look at what I'm doing that's causing my own suffering. Or it's like, I just want you to pet me and tell me it's going to be okay. Ain't no naughty or nice. What do you need to stay balanced in difficult conditions? And then sometimes, I realized this. Actually, I didn't realize this till this is like so obvious, but till getting ready to speak to you, I didn't realize that that's wisdom, compassion and wisdom. It's the two wings of the bird of the Dharma. It's the two wings of the bird of awakening. And that's what we've been doing to each other on the phone. Another one, and I'm not going to give you. I'm not going to unpack the whole like suitcase, but I just want to sort of give you examples, really to inspire you to play with your practice. It's way more art than science. Although sometimes a little science is helpful. A formula can really help sometimes. Like, you know, when I feel like, okay, I'm really lost in some belief and thought that is causing me such suffering, and I really want to cut through this one. I want to slice through that delusion. And one of the resources that I do is the work, Byron Katie's work. Are you familiar with, I'm seeing some heads nodding, by the work by Byron Katie? It's an inquiry process. It's very simple, but not easy. It's just four questions and what she calls a turnaround. So it's an inquiry process where you take often a challenging interpersonal situation where you're sort of struggling with some resistance to life as it is, and you begin to sort of look at the beliefs that you have about how life should be, and you just unpack them, sort of deconstruct them. And it's not that I'm actually letting go of those beliefs, but if you really look at them through this sort of sequence of questions of inquiry, what happens is the questions let go of me. The questions that have been holding me, let go. The thoughts that have been holding me, start to let go. And there's a helpline you can call 24 hours a day. And there's like people from all over the world who volunteer to sort of like walk you through this process. And so it's like, I like asking for help. And I'll just, if there's something that I know I'm totally caught up in, I'll call them and say, you know, I'm going to walk through this one. And somebody from like Taiwan or Germany or like Ohio will be there, and they will, like, walk you through this process. So, and that it's really a way of just working with that switch point of knowing, when I'm awake to knowing I'm fighting this reality. And Byron Katie, she's known as Katie, Katie just says, whenever I fight reality, I lose, but only 100% of the time. And sometimes it's really helpful to have somebody remind me that when I'm fighting reality and I'm going to lose and I'm already losing. The last one that I want to share with you is sort of how I use my own creativity on the cushion. Because a lot of these have been sort of off the cushion stuff. But on the cushion, one of the practices that sort of I've been, again, that I've been using a lot in this season of my life, the season of practice, has been that when I sit down, it's just noticing what is the coordination of the posture that's there. These subtle nuance. It's like when I demonstrated that before, that sort of little spiral in the body that was there. When I was, it's like that yearning spiral and that leaning forward into the future. In any moment, there's some coordination and constellation of sensation in the body. And not necessarily, what I do is, it's like I'll subtly amplify that just for a few seconds to really taste it and know what's there. Not to interpret it, not to create any meaning about it, but just to really know what's present. So, I think that's also that I want to take out of the bag for tonight, just to share with you just some of the variety of ways that I've been practicing with being awake at the switch and protecting my own happiness in difficult conditions. And in the spirit of stating the obvious, it's kind of a odd conundrum because it's difficult conditions. What is it to protect your happiness when you're not happy? Well, it could be that there actually is happiness there that I just haven't noticed yet. So, I'm hearing Mingyur Rinpoche's voice. Calm, peaceful, openness, freedom. Maybe it's there, and I haven't even noticed. So with that, we have a few minutes, and I'm curious what's resonated with you, or what of what you've heard, what has energy, there's questions, that's okay too. So what's landed with you? Yeah.
Well, I was just really struck and appreciative of your spot, so thank you. I mean, you're still a performance artist, so very convenient. But Mark's been talking a lot about open meditation practice. And, you know, if you focus on the breathing, you can do a lot of stuff. It's like, okay, now it's time to do what? And so it's like, and you know, he's been very careful to say, you know, it's really subtle, and you know, you could just be thinking you're doing open meditation. It's like, yeah, I think that's probably what I'm doing. But the way in which you described what happened when you said today was really helpful for me. It was very concrete, and it allowed me to see, oh, that's what Mark's talking about. And it made so much more sense. And so thank you, because that was really helpful. And it really spoke to the freedom that can truly be there in any given moment. So very helpful.
Yeah. Thank you. There's one of the ways that I first got inspired to practice was that a lot of my girlfriends had been practicing for a long time, and they were getting easier to be around. And so that was part of what inspired me. I thought, okay, I could use some of that. But then there was like this fundraiser, and they did this, as part of the fundraiser, they did this little performance thing where they all sat up, they lined up about like 9 of them, and they just started at the same time, like they just started talking about what was going on in their minds when they were practicing, when they were sitting there. And I remember one of my friends sort of sitting there going, it's okay to shake, it's okay to shake. And her body's like shaking on the cushion, and it was like, that's what's going on in your mind as you're doing that. And somebody's saying, oh God, lunch. I forgot to bring lunch. Notice the irritation arising. And it's like, that's what's going on in your mind? So I found it was really helpful to me to get like a little window of what was going on in all these different people's minds as they were practicing. Yes.
I love you pulling out your bag of tricks, you know, and just the variety. And I didn't know Beverly Katie had a 24-hour cell phone. That's really cool. The other thing that I wonder if you could talk a bit more about is using creativity on a cushion, because I'm really good at using creativity every place else, and I don't think I use a lot. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, I feel it's in that service of what does this system need to stay balanced? I feel like that's sort of what, again, often is the compass of what's guiding. So the creativity isn't about entertaining myself. And people often talk about being on the cushion having creativity attacks, and it isn't sort of like cultivating creativity. You know, it really is about, for me, it's about being present. What does this system need to stay balanced? And and not asking that a lot, but just every sort of as an act of friendship with my own mind and my own heart and mind. So that's where, like, okay, I could, you know, I think there's, some of us spend years sitting on this cushion really, like, pretty checked out. And so there's a way in which it's like, okay, that's one option. And, like, that noticing, like, the reason that this practice has evolved right now, where when I sit down, often it's just only at the beginning of the practice, when at a sitting period, when I'll sit, like in the first few minutes, that's when I'll do that direct the mind to what is the constellation of sensation in the body, and immediately there's a dropping in and coming present. And so it serves that, and then, you know, that's sort of a skillful means for showing up on the cushion. So, yeah.
I'm not sure if I heard you correctly, but it sounded like you were sitting and then you would write while you were sitting.
No, that was, I went home and I wrote.
Oh, okay, so after sitting. Okay, I was thinking, how should you do that?
Yes.
What your sit was like when you...
Yes. So that was actually... And I set an intention when I sat down, because I would be giving this talk, that, okay, just an intention that I'm going to remember the sequence of what happens here. And in just inviting that awareness. So... Yeah.
Thank you for all these new angles of looking at things. But there's something I'd love to revisit. I mean, I think it's just because I didn't hear it good, or maybe I don't understand it, but I could revisit what you were saying. The point was not to feel good, or wanting to feel good, or not wanting to feel bad.
Oh, that was about... I want to quote Christine... Kristen Neff, was that was the one about we give ourselves compassion not to feel better, but because we feel bad. Is that the, that was what you wanted me to speak to?
Is that
was
ideal?
Hmm?
Is that an ideal, or is there very much difference?
Yeah, I think there's very, very much difference. And that practice is so much about intention. And compassion, self-compassion, to be directing self-compassion here because there is suffering is really, really different than directing, giving myself self-compassion to make the owie go away. It's subtle but really significant. Yeah.
As an official senior citizen, I often find myself in my practice wanting to be really honest with myself, and I say, fatigue is being known. And I think that, you know, what I'm really seeking is to make it go away. And the real test of it is when it doesn't. So, yes, what do I do with that? You know, and then I can have compassion with myself, and sometimes I feel like I've been through a war. You know, how it just, people in my age bracket, and you can identify with me if you want to, if the shoe fits. But sometimes you just feel like you've been through a war, and you don't want to go on. And I can say, okay, that is being known. I just want to rest. I don't want to put out any more effort, but, you know, there's no let up, it seems like. And sometimes it's just a very hard place to be, to know what to do with that. Because if I try to fight that feeling, of course it will not go away. That's reality.
Yes.
And so then I kind of find myself being stuck in aversion.
Mm-hmm. What's that got to do with being a senior citizen?
That's just my personal dilemma, and I kind of run up against this all the time. And I think the wisdom of it is that I understand the futility of effort. That's my take on it. And I always used to be very active in trying to fix things, and I was a workaholic, you know, and I tried to do stuff. And sometimes I accomplish quite a bit, but it doesn't change that restlessness. And it's so stupid. Because I'm not being here. You know, I'm trying to run away from stuff with effort all the time. So I see the futility of effort now. But then what do I do with that? Here I sit.
Here you sit. I don't know if this is relevant, but I have this, that there's a certain kind of, I think of a kind of a continuum of tension, sort of involved in just being alive. And some of us who have functioned at a lot of, like, energy and a lot of activity, and I was a dancer, a professional dancer for a while, and I remember one of the choreographers I worked with said, you know, Wendy, you dance a lot better when you're sick. And it was completely true. It was completely true because I didn't have the extra effort to expend when I was sick. But I used to conflate my tension with my passion and my getting it done and putting my all in. And when I stopped, when I sort of recognized that was exhausting. It's like at the other end of the continuum is going to sleep. Because I haven't really practiced much of that middle ground. I'm either at this level or I'm at this level. So, and that I think is, there's, it's like whatever the brain does is a lot of is what the brain gets good at. And so if we can notice that just the act of being there, so what do? Well, I just sit there. To be sitting there, and even just ever so more slightly awake to the fatigue or the sleepiness, it's actually has the potential to begin to expand the continuum of how much you get to be in the world and do stuff and be at ease. But if you haven't done it, if you've been doing this other thing, this is pretty unknown territory.
Well, and I'm finding that a lot of times I will feel guilty for not doing anything. So when I'm sitting there, I'm thinking I should be up doing something. I say, knock it off! It's okay to relax. So that's new for me.
Okay.
But, you know, then what do I do with that?
Okay.
I'm just relaxed.
One of the things that you might try doing is like if you could just tweak the tone of voice with the knock it off. It's like that, you know, just to you know, that it's like the it's like, what is it? That's where when I was talking about the self-compassion and the tone, to be welcoming ourselves when we're not where we want to be, which is what we are doing. So that it's like noticing, being present to the antidote to it sounds like a little bit guilt and somewhat shame, and the antidote to shame is self-compassion. So in that moment, to be able to, with even the tone of your voice, oh, this isn't where I want to be. Yeah, thank you. Last question, comment.
Oh boy, that's a lot of pressure.
Okay, or not. Pretend there's five people coming after you.
Okay. I just really relate to what you're saying, and I'm not a senior citizen. Just in how I'm not, I know, it's shocking. How practicing on and off the mat, and what you were saying about, like, there's basically, like, awake and sleep, and there's no in between, and that it's not like it's easy, but I have this incredible set of expectations of what I'm supposed to be doing and who I'm supposed to be at any given moment, that if I stop and take time to think about it, which is horrifying, I get to go, oh, like, I'm in a really crappy mood today, and I'm not in the mood to smile at anybody, even though I have spent years of my life cultivating the idea that people should see me that way. For a long list of reasons. And so it just feels like this whole what you said really helped me see that about my own practice, and how practicing self-compassion for myself is also just continually going, like, you don't have to be that right now.
Thank you. That's why we do this together.
Thank you.
So I want to just take just a minute to sort of close up this evening, this part of this evening. We're just going to have about 15 minutes after this for, like, treats and the tea, if you'd like to. And before we go there, I'd just like to invite you just to come into awareness of how you're sitting in this moment. If you'd like to, you can close your eyes or softly cast the gaze downward. And I just would like to invite us just to ask that whatever merit has been generated by our practice this evening, whatever wholesomeness has been invoked, to dedicate that to the people that we love and care about, the people who come to Common Ground, the people who would have liked to have been here this evening, weren't able to? The people in this neighborhood? In the city? People in the region? People on the opposite side of the world, and the people in between. Being seen and unseen, may the merit of our time together, may that be dedicated to them all. And if there's anything that I have said this evening that has in any way been hurtful to you, please forgive me. May you be awake at the switch, protecting your own happiness as we move out into the world.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.